get away with murder.
You make me so happy.
The best disguise is a smile.
I've got a little present for you.
A high-flying businesswoman plots vicious vengeance.
They described it as a bloodbath.
There's nothing we could do.
A widow is unlucky in love. Again and again.
She got away with it, and she got money.
And a caring grandmother masks a dark past.
She doesn't have no conscience.
With charm and a kind word, these deadly women hide in plain sight, daring the law to catch me if you can. Vancouver, Canada, 1991. Two women from very different backgrounds forge a close bond.
Guess what I've got?
Woohoo!
Champagne.
Their children went to the same school.
And then friendship sort of blossomed from there.
I love your necklace.
Thank you. Gift from my father.
40-year-old Gladys Wakabayashi is the daughter of a Taiwanese billionaire.
Here's long life and success.
53-year-old Jean James makes her own way to the top.
Jean James was a successful professional woman who was the head of a large union of flight attendants.
Despite their differences, the women have one thing in common. Their smiles mask secret heartbreak. Gladys's marriage is on the rocks.
Just wasn't working.
She turns to Jean for comfort.
Gladys separated from her husband, and they were living apart.
Marital problems are something Jean knows all about.
Jean and Derek James seem to have it all. Money, good reputations, everything, except a happy marriage.
Jean secretly suspects her husband Derek is fooling around.
You're home early.
Yeah, I've got to have business dinner.
There were tensions in the marriage. That became apparent.
You don't know them. They're from out of town.
And her suspicions are right.
Derek had a number of affairs.
Jean turns a blind eye until she fears Derek is straying close to home.
She had expressed that concern to a number of her friends. She was quite upset.
She hires a private investigator to find out the truth.
Check and see who's been calling.
She had somebody obtain the hotel records of Derek's business trip to Toronto in Eastern Canada.
The records reveal her worst fear.
I'm going to go to bed now.
Jean's husband is having an affair with her close friend, Gladys.
She was particularly upset because Gladys was a friend of hers. She felt, a real sense of betrayal.
Gorgeous.
Jean apparently accepted that her husband had many affairs. But when she found out he was having an affair with a friend of hers, it drove her over the edge.
Inside, Jean is crushed, but she doesn't show it.
It went down the same way as the rest of her professional life did. Cool, calm, and collected.
hurt by two people she loves. Jean displays an unexpected emotion.
Hi, Gladys. It's Jean.
Kindness.
Oh, great. I've got a little present for you.
Jean wanted to visit Gladys and told her that she had a gift for her.
See you soon. Bye.
Done, Jean.
I saw this. I knew it would be perfect for you.
Oh, Jean.
Since Gladys was having an affair with Jean's husband, there had to have been some unspoken tension between the women.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's perfect.
I love it.
Gladys would be trying very hard to act as if nothing was wrong.
Shall I try it on?
Mm-hmm. But this friendly gesture isn't what it appears.
Let me.
She tricked her by bringing her a necklace. She tricked her by saying, "Let me put it on your neck for you."
I know you're sleeping with my husband.
Don't be silly, Jean.
Don't you laugh at me.
Illicit affairs can be very exciting and very deadly.
Vancouver, June 24th, 1992. 53-year-old Jean James is a woman scorned. And now her husband's lover, close friend, 41-year-old Gladys Wakabayashi, is at her mercy.
I know you're sleeping with my husband.
Gladys's neck was exposed.
Don't you laugh at me.
This would have put her in an extremely vulnerable position.
No, not Jean, no.
Jean makes a superficial cut, deep enough to weaken Gladys, but not to kill her.
Jean wanted information. She wanted to know how long the affair had been going on.
Jean's aim is to torture a confession out of Gladys.
She repeatedly stabbed her in the chest and other parts of the body. It was a real bloodletting.
The truth!
But Gladys either won't...
Tell me the truth!
...or can't respond. And finally, Jean runs out of patience.
Then she slashed her in the neck, cutting through Gladys' jugular vein.
Gladys had to die. Perhaps she feared losing her husband to her friend. Or perhaps the fact that her friend was having sex with her husband was just too much to bear. When investigators got there, they described it as a bloodbath.
And in Gladys's blood, a telltale clue.
A shoe print, a high-heeled shoe.
The print suggests the killer is a woman. And when police learn of Gladys and Derek's illicit affair, they have a prime suspect. Jean James.
Are these all your shoes?
Yes, they're all in there.
Did you go to her house on June 24?
No.
So they searched the house, they searched the car, and they weren't able to find anything.
Nothing. Thank you, ma'am.
Jean has taken her revenge and left no trace.
Jean was a smart woman. She planned this crime down to the last detail.
They'd had basically insufficient evidence to lay charges, so that's where the case rested at that point.
The investigation stalls. And as quickly as she turned to murder, Jean switches back to being a regular housewife.
By all appearances, she was just, you know, an ordinary middle-class citizen living her life out in a nice suburb of Vancouver.
I need a cash offer.
Then, in 2007, 16 years after Gladys's murder, Jean gets an unlikely chance to dabble again in a life of crime. An acquaintance asks her to be a money launderer for a drug ring.
I earn that in 2 days.
Lucky you.
Unbelievably, the now 70-year-old Jean wants in.
You interested?
I am.
She probably figured she got away with murder once. Why not make a career of it?
Jean wants to climb the crime syndicate ladder. On November 27th, 2007, she goes to meet Mr. Big.
How do I know you can handle the big stuff?
You don't know me.
Killers just love to talk. They can't talk to just anyone about killing. But if they think they're in good company, they will brag.
To prove she is ruthless enough to join the gang's inner circle, Jean reveals her most closely guarded secret.
I found my husband screwing around, so I decided to kill her.
You killed her?
I slit her throat and let her bleed out.
You're under arrest.
Jean has been duped. The entire scenario is an undercover sting run by Canadian police.
She never thought that law enforcement would lay a trap for her and that she would walk right into it and admit to everything.
After 16 years, her big mouth finally traps Jean.
The Royal Canadian Mounted Police are known for always getting their man. This time, they got their woman.
For the family of Gladys Wakabayashi, justice at last. Jean is convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to 25 years to life.
So she'll probably never see the light of day again.
Jean wanted to keep bad company, and now she is.
If you can't put a price on love.
And she immediately went out and bought a $250 life insurance policy.
Can you put a price on marriage?
You were really subjecting them to an agonizing death.
For some women, the answer is yes.
How dare you?
She got away with it, and she got money.
Annie, Barbara, so pleased you could make it.
In New Haven, Connecticut, 1907, Annie Paulman is an unexpected guest on the social scene.
Nice to meet you.
Annie was a widow after the death of her first husband in 1906.
I'm surprised to see Annie here. She's not one for mourning long.
And I don't think you've met Joseph Monahan.
No, I haven't had the pleasure.
Pleasure? It's all mine.
it is unusual for a recent widow to be socializing.
I thought you two could be partners.
Annie's never been afraid to break the rules.
A splendid idea.
Annie wasn't one for protocol and custom.
It's like that, okay.
She liked to have her own way. Tell people what she wants and expect them to do it. She didn't take guff off of anybody.
She's out of cards. She wins.
Annie's charm is legendary. It lets her get away with most anything.
I feel we should warn Joseph.
Hush, dear. Don't spread rumors.
Annie was arrested for suspicion of murder regarding her first husband. But she wasn't charged, and they released her.
38-year-old Joseph Monahan ignores the gossip. He's smitten.
I can't wear your dead husband's clothes.
What? Why? He doesn't need them.
After a short courtship, they marry.
Now let's not talk about it.
It was all about Annie and what Annie wanted. And in her mind...
Why, Mrs. Monahan?
What Annie wanted, Annie got.
His family welcomes Joseph's new bride, particularly his younger brother, John.
Hey, I brought John home for dinner. You don't mind, do you?
Of course not.
Bye. Whiskey?
Sure, yeah.
It's good to see you again.
Looking stunning, as always.
Oh, stop.
Annie's allure has no bounds. Neither does her appetite for men. Which is just as well. She's having a run of bad luck. A little over a year into Annie's new marriage, Joseph becomes sick. Annie nurses him.
Brother.
But he slides downhill.
It looks worse.
It's long and slow and horrible.
There's nothing they could do.
Annie is widowed again.
It was another sudden, unexpected death. And once again, she was questioned.
He wanted to be embalmed.
We can arrange that.
But whatever suspicions police have, they can't land a charge.
That tells me she was probably pretty good at talking to the police.
Annie's legendary charm doesn't just work on cops. She's already lined up her next husband and raises eyebrows.
Only 2 months after her second husband died, she married his younger brother, John.
The priest said to her,
"Before we continue, I'm compelled to ask you a question.
It's only been a month since your husband died, and this man has the same last name as your previous husband.
Are they at all related?"
And Annie stood there, looked in the priest's eyes, and told her bald-faced lie.
Absolutely not.
Annie married her third husband when she was under suspicion for murdering the second one.
You may kiss the girl.
Along with a new marriage comes a new life insurance policy.
She immediately went out and bought a $250 life insurance policy on John Monahan for the sum of 15 cents a week.
This marriage lasts for a while at least. But when Annie's 17-year-old niece, Jenny McNamee, comes to stay, trouble returns.
Jenny had lost both of her parents. Her mother was Annie's sister. So, of course, Annie took her in.
Jenny settles in well to her new home. A little too well for Annie's liking.
Jenny, don't you have chores to do? I'm just having fun.
A little too much, I'd say.
Really?
In 1913, illness strikes again. Not Annie's husband, her niece.
Just rest quietly.
But the ever-cautious Annie has insured her, too, just in case.
Annie insured her 17-year-old niece with three different life insurance companies for a grand total of $2,400. That was a lot of money back then.
Is she going to be okay?
Jenny's doctors think it could be food poisoning.
She just needs rest.
All they knew was that she had stomach and intestinal trouble. They didn't know what was wrong.
If it was gastrointestinal issues, it was usually attributed to spoiled food. Sometimes people die from that. If they're living with Annie, it's probably another reason.
New Haven, Connecticut, 1913. Annie Monahan looks on as her 17-year-old niece, Jenny McNamee, loses her fight with a mysterious illness.
She's not suffering anymore.
She should never have suffered.
Annie's run of misfortune is becoming a little too much to believe.
Two husbands within 3 years, both dead, unexpectedly. Then a niece, 17 years old, completely healthy before she came under Annie's care. The investigators were very suspicious of Annie.
With mounting circumstantial evidence, police order an autopsy on Jenny's body.
They found enough arsenic in her body to kill six people.
The police exhume Annie's two husbands to look for more arsenic. But she's one step ahead.
He wanted to be embalmed.
Of course.
The fact that they were embalmed with liquid arsenic meant she could never be caught for poisoning them with arsenic.
The case crumbles. There is no way to prove Annie gave her niece the poison.
There just didn't seem to be enough evidence to successfully prosecute.
How dare they smear my good name?
Annie may be free and rich thanks to another insurance payout, but there's trouble brewing with her husband.
That's because you're a murderer.
How dare you?
You're despicable.
Sometimes when they would argue and fight, he would call her a murderer. He had no idea how accurate that was.
Annie could have tried to talk her husband around, but that's not her style.
Eat up, Joan.
It could be argued that arsenic murder is a much more sadistic way of killing somebody than, let's say, the way Jack the Ripper killed his victims.
For a fourth time, Annie Monahan watches a loved one's drawn-out demise. before Annie can have another husband embalmed, the police strike.
They weren't fooling around this time. They sent all of his internal organs to Yale Medical School for analysis.
Results show fatal arsenic levels, coupled with evidence from her niece's death. Annie's charm has worn off.
At her trial, Annie shouted, "I'm innocent. You've tried to get me every time." I'll take that as a confession.
In February 1919, Annie Monahan is found guilty of the murder of her husband, John. She is sentenced to life in prison, where she dies, a notorious serial killer.
Annie needed two things in life to be happy: a victim and a bottle of arsenic.
People like to believe you can escape your history.
They viewed her as bad news.
But some women,
that promiscuous behavior signals something bad is going on,
will never outrun their past.
She doesn't have no conscience.
In 2007, Pulaski, Tennessee. 64-year-old house cleaner Linda McElroy takes pride in her work.
She was considered by people that knew her in the community to be a wonderful woman.
Linda's been here in Pulaski for 35 years. Locals think they know her. They don't.
Linda would have had to have been constantly looking over her shoulder, waiting for the little idyllic life that she built for herself just to come crashing down around her.
You don't think that you're going to find somebody like this in your small town.
Well, howdy, Sheriff. Come on in. What can I do you for?
Linda? You need to come with me.
Wind back the clock almost 50 years to 1961 in the Riverside city of Ashland, Kentucky. Linda is an 18-year-old stay-at-home mom.
In her first marriage, Linda had four children, little kids.
But the teen wife can't wait to trade domestic drudgery for a night out.
She had a reputation in the community as being a woman who liked to have a good time.
I'm going to Sims tonight.
You're always going down.
Are you kidding? I stay at home all day with the kids.
Okay.
But what her husband doesn't know is that Linda's not meeting her girlfriends.
Linda and Charles started seeing one another while Linda was still married to her first husband.
She would go out and sneak out with Charles.
17-year-old Charles Darby is head over heels for Linda.
Oh, you made me so happy.
Me too.
Charles Darby was known as a very hardworking, very industrious type individual.
He was a sweet person, very funny, very energetic.
I hate going back to him.
Do you mean that?
Yeah. I do.
Charles persuades Linda to divorce her husband.
There was a little bit of a scandal over that. That type of behavior is very much frowned upon in a very small, close-knit conservative community like Ashland.
In 1962, Charles marries Linda. The newlyweds move to Hammond, Indiana, far from Charles's family.
Her husband chose her and became isolated and estranged from his own family. Big mistake.
7 years later, Charles struggles to support Linda's four children and one of their own.
Ready or not, here I come.
Neither of them had regular employment. They were getting by on what Charles was bringing in through his carpentry business, which wasn't much.
Linda treats herself to fine clothes anyway.
Oh, shoot.
Neglecting the bills.
Don't worry about kids.
They got their gas cut off and it cold. Their electric was cut off. And he found out she wasn't paying the bills.
When confronted about the unpaid bills, Linda comes up with a shocking revelation.
I gave you money for the bill?
About where the money's gone.
You spent it on yourself.
On a doctor's appointment. I have cancer.
She told him she'd been going to the doctor, and she told him she had cancer. Well, they didn't have any insurance where he was self-employed.
It's tragic, heartbreaking, and entirely make-believe.
Linda even lied to Charles about having cancer and that she needed more money for treatment.
When Charles discovers the lie, he takes drastic action.
I warned you.
Charles did place an ad in the newspaper at one time stating that he was not responsible for his wife's debts, that he was responsible for no one's debts other than his own.
How could you? This is embarrassing.
You gave me no choice.
That didn't sit too well with her at all.
The public put down turns Charles's wife into his enemy.
Charles knew Linda was bad news, but he wouldn't leave her. That was a fatal mistake.
Hammond, Indiana, 1970. Father of five, Charles Darby, comes down with an unknown illness.
He couldn't seem to shake the symptoms.
Thank you.
His wife, Linda, dotes on him until...
I'm going to visit my father. He's really ill.
She tells him she's going to take the kids to visit her parents.
You'll be okay.
Leaving Charles to fend for himself.
Leaving a spouse who is in the throes of a very severe illness like Charles was certainly odd behavior.
Linda is gone for 4 days. On March 4th, 1970, she returns to Hammond. But she doesn't go home.
She decided to stop and get a motel room, which was curious.
With the kids in a motel bed, Linda has an errand to run.
Where are you going?
She left the older children in the motel room by themselves.
You can't tell anybody that.
She had told them that if they said anything about her leaving the motel, that she would spank them.
She took the youngest, the baby, with her.
After leaving the motel, Linda makes a pit stop.
She had filled up 2 5-gallon cans of gas.
After that, Linda went to the house that she, the children, and Charles all shared.
She left Chucky in the car as she went to do what she had to do.
Charles was asleep. She retrieves a shotgun. And she shoots Charles in the side with that shotgun.
And then she puts him inside of a garment bag and zips him up. And then pours all that gas on him in the bed. And then strikes a match.
And keep in mind that Linda has the baby that she and Charles had together with her at the time. Just the fact that she would have that baby with her is diabolical.
She doesn't have no conscience. Not at all.
Linda flees the scene. When police arrive, they quickly deduce this is no accident.
For one thing, it's very obvious that an accelerant was used to start the fire.
That's not the only mistake Linda makes.
She left a trail of evidence.
Linda was identified by the service station attendant. There were tire tracks recovered at the scene that matched the tires on Linda's vehicle.
She didn't hide the gun well. The police found it behind the vending machine at the motel.
And finally, Charles's body reveals something diabolical. Linda laid the groundwork for this murder months earlier.
They said that, you know, he'd been poisoned for months.
In October 1970, Linda Darby is convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life inside the Indiana State Women's Prison.
The family was very relieved because they thought, you know, she would pay for the crime she had done, for taking his life.
But after just 2 years behind bars, Linda gets a chance at freedom.
In 1972, Linda scales a fence at the Indiana State Women's Prison. It wasn't a well-planned escape attempt. It was just spontaneous. She saw the opportunity and she took it.
The escape leaves her with minor cuts.
Are you okay? William, get out here.
After she escaped, she met a man named Willie McElroy Jr.
She's been dating my boyfriend. Oh, help her in the house.
You're safe here.
Willie took pity on her. She told him that she'd been beaten by her boyfriend. That was what accounted for the cuts and bruises. Willie, being the kind-hearted soul that he was, he took her in, and eventually a romance blossomed between the two of them.
She remarried and had two more children with her husband, Willie.
For the next 35 years, Linda Darby plays the role of Linda McElroy, a law-abiding wife, mother, and even grandmother.
Linda opened a little junk shop. She cleaned houses. She took care of the elderly, and there was never any inkling that she was in fact a convicted murderer living on the run.
Linda thinks she can hide forever in this tiny rural town. But there's something she hasn't counted on: the rise of technology.
They set up a new computer-based system for tracking escaped fugitives.
In 2007, the state of Tennessee begins using new software aimed at smoking out prison escapees.
They found on Linda Darby that there were some similarities by her social security number, by her date of birth, and other data that they collect that looked similar to a woman by the name of Linda McElroy, who lived in Plaski, Tennessee.
All it takes is a knock at the door.
Howdy, Sheriff. Come on in.
And the fugitive murderer, Linda Darby, is at last returned to custody.
She's lived on the run for 35 years. They set up this new program, and in 72 hours, she's back behind bars. Same institution where she scaled the fence 35 years earlier.
Linda will now serve out the rest of her days behind bars.
She'll die in there. And I don't feel sorry for that, because she'll pay for it.
When she was arrested, the community rallied around her and didn't think she should go to prison because she had been such a good girl for 35 years. Living a crime-free life for 35 years does not make up for murdering an innocent man. Linda had to pay.
These deadly women thought they would never have to pay for their crimes. Jean James cut her best friend out of her life. Annie Monahan believed her luck would never run out. And Linda Darby reinvented herself to conceal her heinous history. All three thought they could run and hide forever, taunting, "Catch me if you can." Later that day, Gladys's daughter waits at school for a mother who never comes.
So father came and picked up his daughter, Eliza, and they drove back to Gladys's home.
The home is silent. Nothing seems wrong.
Where are they?
Until Shinji enters the bedroom.
Gladys! Where are you?
Gladys!
There's blood on the walls, blood on the covered her body, blood all over the carpet, and it's just a really grisly scene.
The police are called and find Gladys has bled to death.
first-degree murder, they need to prove premeditation, and she was had obviously taken steps. She came to the house in a surreptitious way, you know, parked a vehicle a good distance away and lurked through the alleys and before she came to the house, and, you know, she had the weapon with her and she had the intent. She carried it out and, you know, took all the steps to try to cover her tracks afterwards. Absolutely premeditated.
He was calling her a murderer, and that was a little dangerous. So, what could she do but kill him?
In 1917, Annie decides John's life insurance policy needs a boost.
Annie tried to get more life insurance on him. But the insurance companies smelled a rat and denied it.
Financial gain may not have been Annie's only motivation. Some believe she killed to satisfy another, more depraved urge.
There is every reason to believe that in addition to whatever financial motives are fueling the crimes, you know, they're actually deriving, you know, very, very sick, sadistic, sometimes even sexual pleasure from inflicting this agony on their loved ones.
The evidence for this theory is that poisoners like Annie keep killing, even when they no longer need the cash.
It's not as though they stop committing the crimes after they've made enough money off of insurance.
He doesn't mind that Linda's married with kids or care about her tainted reputation.
She was very promiscuous.
Charles's niece, Teresa Bond, was only young at the time, but she remembers the stories about Aunt Linda.
I know that Charles wasn't the only one that she was sneaking out with.
She had numerous affairs.
One of those who frown upon newly divorced Linda is Charles's mother, Alice.
Charles.
Mamma begged Charles Raymond not to marry her.
I'm gonna marry her.
No!
And he wouldn't listen.
Linda could have divorced Charles, but divorce isn't easy. Murder makes the problem go away. Sympathy for the widow. And the government would have given her a monthly check to help raise the kids. She was responsible. She was admired and respected by others. She took care of people. I think Linda didn't want to bring any attention to herself, so she went on the straight and narrow.